Chapter 9. The Numinous. Wonder is the basis of worship. Thomas Carlyle, Sartor Resartus, 1833-34. I maintain that the cosmic religious feeling is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research. Albert Einstein, Ideas and Opinions, 1954. She could recall the exact moment when, on one of many trips to Washington, she discovered that she was falling in love with Kendra Heer. Arrangements for the meeting with Palmer Joss seemed to be taking forever. Apparently, Joss was reluctant to visit the Argus facility. It was the impiety of the scientists, not their interpretation of the message, he now said, that interested him. And to probe their character, some more neutral ground was needed. Ellie was willing to go anywhere, and a special assistant to the president was negotiating. Other radio astronomers were not to go. The president wanted it to be Ellie alone. Ellie was also waiting for the day, still some weeks off, when she would fly to Paris for the first full meeting of the World Message Consortium. She and Vega were coordinating the Global Data Collection Program. The signal acquisition was now fairly routine, and in recent months there had been not one gap in the coverage. So she found to her surprise that she had a little time on her hands. She vowed to have a long talk with her mother, and to remain civil and friendly, no matter what provocation was offered. There was an absurd amount of backed-up paper and electronic mail to go through, not just congratulations and criticisms from colleagues, but religious admonitions, pseudo-scientific speculations proposed with great confidence, and fan mail from all over the world. She had not read the Astrophysical Journal in months, although she was the first author of a very recent paper that was surely the most extraordinary article that had ever appeared in that august publication. The signal from Vega was so strong that many amateurs, tired of ham radio, had begun constructing their own small radio telescopes and signal analyzers. In the early stages of message acquisition, they had turned up some useful data, and Ellie was still besieged by amateurs who thought they had acquired something unknown to the SETI professionals. She felt an obligation to write encouraging letters. There were other meritorious radio astronomy programs at the facility, the quasar survey, for example, that needed attending to. But instead of doing all these things, she found herself spending almost all her time with Ken. Of course, it was her duty to involve the president's science advisor in Project Argus as deeply as he wished. It was important that the president be fully and competently informed. She hoped the leaders of other nations would be as thoroughly briefed on the findings from Vega as was the president of the United States. This president, while untrained in science, genuinely liked the subject and was willing to support science, not only for its practical benefits, but at least a little for the joy of knowing. This had been true of few previous American leaders since James Madison and John Quincy Adams. Still, it was remarkable how much time Jahir was able to spend at Argus. He did devote an hour or more each day in high bandpass scrambled communications with his Office of Science and Technology Policy in the old executive office building in Washington. But the rest of the time, as far as she could see, he was simply around. He would poke into the innards of the computer system or visit individual radio telescopes. Sometimes an assistant from Washington would be with him. More often, he would be alone. She would see him through the open door of the spare office they had assigned him, his feet propped up on the desk, reading some report or talking on the phone. He would offer her a cheery wave and return to his work. She would find him talking casually with Drumlin or Valerian, but equally so with junior technicians and with the secretarial staff, who had on more than one occasion pronounced him within Ellie's hearing charming. Jahir had many questions for her as well. At first they were purely technical and programmatic, but soon they extended to plans for a wide variety of conceivable future events, and then to untrammeled speculation. These days it almost seemed that discussion of the project was only a pretext to spend a little time together. One fine autumn afternoon in Washington, The president was obliged to delay a meeting of the Special Contingency Task Group because of the Tyrone Free crisis. After an overnight flight from New Mexico, Ellie and Derheer found themselves with an unscheduled few hours and decided to visit the Vietnam Memorial, designed by Maya Ying Lin when she was still an undergraduate architectural student at Yale. Amidst the somber and doleful reminders of a foolish war, Derheer seemed inappropriately cheerful, and Ellie began again to speculate about flaws in his character. A pair of General Service Administration plainclothes security people, their custom-molded flesh-colored earpieces in place, followed discreetly. He had coaxed an exquisite blue caterpillar to climb aboard a twig. It briskly padded along, its iridescent body rippling with the motion of 14 pairs of feet. At the end of the twig, it held on with its last 5 segments and flailed the air in a plucky attempt to find a new perch. Unsuccessful, it turned itself around smartly and retraced its many steps. Derheer then changed his clutch on the twig so that when the caterpillar returned to its starting point, there was again nowhere to go. Like some caged mammalian carnivore, it paced back and forth many times. But in the last few passages, it seemed to her, with increasing resignation. She was beginning to feel pity for the poor creature, even if it proved to be, say, the larva responsible for the barley blight. "What a wonderful program in this little guy's head," he exclaimed. "It works every time. Optimum escape software. And he knows not to fall off. I mean, the twig is effectively suspended in air. The caterpillar never experiences that in nature because the twig is always connected to something." "Ellie, did you ever wonder what that program would feel like if it was in your head? I mean, would it just seem obvious to you what you had to do when you came to the end of a twig? Would you have the impression you were thinking it through? Would you wonder how you knew to shake your front 10 feet in the air but hold on tight with the other 18? She inclined her head slightly and examined him rather than the caterpillar. He seemed to have little difficulty imagining her as an insect. She tried to reply noncommittally, reminding herself that for him this would be a matter of professional interest. "What do you do with it now?" "I'll put it back down in the grass, I guess. What else would you do with it?" "Some people might kill it. It's hard to kill a creature once it lets you see its consciousness." He continued to carry both twig and larva. They walked for a while in silence, past almost 55,000 names engraved in reflecting black granite. "Every government that prepares for war paints its adversaries as monsters," she said. "They don't want you thinking of the other side as human. If the enemy can think and feel, you might hesitate to kill them. And killing is very important. Better to see them as monsters."
"Yeah, look at this beauty," he replied after a moment. "Really, look closely."
She did. Fighting back a small tremor of revulsion, she tried to see it through his eyes.
"Watch what it does," he continued. "If it was as big as you or me, it would scare everybody to death. It would be a genuine monster, right? But it's little. It eats leaves, minds its own business, and adds a little beauty to the world."
She took the hand not preoccupied with the caterpillar, and they walked wordlessly past the ranks of names inscribed in chronological order of death. These were, of course, only the American casualties. Except in the hearts of their families and friends, there was no comparable memorial anywhere on the planet for the 2 million people of Southeast Asia who had also died in the conflict. In America, the most common public comment about this war was about political hamstringing of military power, psychologically akin, she thought, to the stab-in-the-back explanation by German militarists of their World War I defeat. The Vietnam War was a pustule on the national conscience that no president so far had the courage to lance. Subsequent policies of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam had not made this task easier.
She remembered how common it was for American soldiers to call their Vietnamese adversaries gooks, slopeheads, slant eyes, and worse. Could we possibly manage the next phase of human history without first dealing with this penchant for dehumanizing the adversary? In everyday conversation, Jurheer didn't talk like an academic. If you met him at the corner newsstand buying a paper, you'd never guess he was a scientist. He hadn't lost his New York street accent. At first, the apparent incongruity between his language and the quality of his scientific work seemed amusing to his colleagues. As his research and the man himself became better known, his accent became merely idiosyncratic. But his pronunciation of, say, guanosine triphosphate seemed to give this benign molecule explosive properties. They had been slow in recognizing that they were falling in love. It must have been apparent to many others. A few weeks before, when Lunacharsky was still at Argus, he launched himself on one of his occasional tirades on the irrationality of language. This time, it was the turn of American English. Ellie, why do people say, make the same mistake again? What does again add to the sentence? And am I right that burn up and burn down mean the same thing? Slow up and slow down mean the same thing? So if screw up is acceptable, why not screw down? She nodded wearily. She had heard him more than once complain to his Soviet colleagues on the inconsistencies of the Russian language, and was sure she would hear a French edition of all this at the Paris conference. She was happy to admit that languages had infelicities, but they had so many sources and evolved in response to so many small pressures that it would be astonishing if they were perfectly coherent and internally consistent. Vege had such a good time complaining, though, that she ordinarily did not have the heart to remonstrate with him.
And take this phrase, head over heels in love, he continued. This is a common expression, yes, but it's exactly backward, or rather upside down. You are ordinarily head over heels. When you are in love, you should be heels over head. Am I right? You would know about falling in love. But whoever invented this phrase did not know about love. He imagined you walk around in the usual way instead of floating upside down in the air like the work of that French painter. What's his name?
He was Russian, she replied. Marc Chagall had provided a narrow pathway out of a somewhat awkward conversational thicket. Afterward, she wondered if Vege had been teasing her or probing for a response. Perhaps he had only unconsciously recognized the growing bond between Ellie and Jurheer. At least part of Jurheer's reluctance was clear. Here he was, the president's science advisor, devoting an enormous amount of time to an unprecedented, delicate, and volatile matter. To become emotionally involved with one of the principals was risky. The president certainly wanted his judgment unimpaired. He should be able to recommend courses of action that Ellie opposed, and to urge rejection of options that she supported. Falling in love with Ellie would, on some level, compromise Jurheer's effectiveness. For Ellie, it was more complicated. Before she had acquired the somewhat staid respectability of the directorship of a major radio observatory, she had had many partners. While she had felt herself in love and declared herself so, marriage had never seriously tempted her. She dimly remembered the quatrain, was it William Butler Yeats, with which she had tried to reassure her early swains, heartbroken because, as always, she had determined that the affair was over. You say there is no love, my love, unless it lasts for a... Ah, folly, there are episodes far better than the play. She recalled how charming John Stoughton had been to her while courting her mother, and how easily he had cast off this pose after he became her stepfather. Some new and monstrous persona, hitherto barely glimpsed, could emerge in men shortly after you married them. Her romantic predispositions made her vulnerable, she thought. She was not going to repeat her mother's mistake. A little deeper was a fear of falling in love without reservation, of committing herself to someone who might then be snatched from her, or simply leave her. But if you never really fall in love, you can never really miss it. She did not dwell on this sentiment, dimly aware that it did not ring quite true. Also, if she never really fell in love with someone, she could never really betray him, as in her heart of hearts she felt that her mother had betrayed her long-dead father. She still missed him terribly. With Ken, it seemed to be different, or had her expectations been gradually compromised over the years. Unlike many other men she could think of, when challenged or stressed, Ken displayed a gentler, more compassionate side. His tendency to compromise and his skill in scientific politics were part of the accoutrements of his job. But underneath, she felt she had glimpsed something solid. She respected him for the way he had integrated science into the whole of his life, and for the courageous support for science that he had tried to inculcate into two administrations. They had, as discreetly as possible, been staying together more or less in her small apartment at Argus. Their conversations were a joy, with ideas flying back and forth like shuttlecocks. Sometimes they responded to each other's uncompleted thoughts with almost perfect foreknowledge. He was a considerate and inventive lover, and anyway, she liked his pheromones. She was sometimes amazed at what she was able to do and say in his presence because of their love. She came to admire him so much that his love for her affected her own self-esteem. She liked herself better because of him. And since he clearly felt the same, there was a kind of infinite regress of love and respect underlying their relationship. At least, that was how she described it to herself. In the presence of so many of her friends, she had felt an undercurrent of loneliness. With Ken, it was gone. She was comfortable describing to him her reveries, snatches of memories, childhood embarrassments, and he was not merely interested but fascinated. He would question her for hours about her childhood. His questions were always direct, sometimes probing, but without exception, gentle. She began to understand why lovers talk baby talk to one another. There was no other socially acceptable circumstance in which the children inside her were permitted to come out. If the 1-year-old, the 5-year-old, the 12-year-old, and the 20-year-old all find compatible personalities in the beloved, there is a real chance to keep all of these sub-personas happy. Love ends their long loneliness. Perhaps the depth of love can be calibrated by the number of different selves that are actively involved in a given relationship. With her previous partners, it seemed, at most one of these selves was able to find a compatible opposite number. The other personas were grumpy hangers-on. The weekend before the scheduled meeting with Joss, they were lying in bed as the late afternoon sunlight, admitted between the slats of the Venetian blinds, played patterns on their intertwined forms. "In ordinary conversation," she was saying, "I can talk about my father without feeling more than a slight pang of loss. But if I allow myself to really remember him, his sense of humor, say, or that passionate fairness, then the facade crumbles and I want to weep because he's gone." "No question. Language can free us of feeling. Or almost," Durheer replied, stroking her shoulder. "Maybe that's one of its functions, so we can understand the world without becoming entirely overwhelmed by it." "If so, then the invention of language isn't only a blessing. You know, Ken, I'd give anything. I really mean anything I have if I could just spend a few minutes with my dad." She imagined a heaven with all those nice moms and dads floating about or flapping over to a nearby cloud. It would have to be a commodious place to accommodate all the tens of billions of people who had lived and died since the emergence of the human species. It might be very crowded, she was thinking, unless the religious heaven was built on a scale something like the astronomical heaven. Then there'd be room to spare.
There must be some number, Ellie said, that measures the total population of intelligent beings in the Milky Way. How many do you suppose it is? If there's 1 million civilizations, each with about 1 billion individuals, that's 10^15 intelligent beings. But if most of them are more advanced than we are, maybe the idea of individuals becomes inappropriate. Maybe that's just another Earth chauvinism.
Sure. And then you can calculate the galactic production rate of Gauloises and Twinkies and Volga sedans and Sony Pocket communicators. Then we could calculate the gross galactic product. Once we have that in hand, we could work on the gross cosmic.
You're making fun of me, she said with a soft smile, not at all displeased. But think about such numbers. I mean, really think about them. All those planets with all those beings more advanced than we are. Don't you get a kind of tingle thinking about it? She could tell what he was thinking, but rushed on. Here, look at this. I've been reading up for the meeting with Joss.
She reached toward the bedside table for volume 16 of an old Encyclopedia Britannica Macropedia, titled Rubens to Somalia, and opened to a page where a scrap of computer printout had been inserted as a bookmark. She pointed to an article called Sacred or Holy. The theologians seem to have recognized a special, non-rational, I wouldn't call it irrational, aspect of the feeling of sacred or holy. They call it numinous. The term was first used by, somebody named Rudolf Otto in a 1923 book, The Idea of the Holy. He believed that humans were predisposed to detect and revere the numinous. He called it the mysterium tremendum. Even my Latin is good enough for that. In the presence of the mysterium tremendum, people feel utterly insignificant. But, if I read this right, not personally alienated. He thought of the numinous as a thing wholly other, and the human response to it as absolute astonishment. Now, if that's what religious people talk about when they use words like sacred or holy, I'm with them. I felt something like that just in listening for a signal, never mind in actually receiving it. I think all of science elicits that sense of awe. Now listen to this, she read from the text. Throughout the past 100 years, a number of philosophers and social scientists have asserted the disappearance of the sacred and predicted the demise of religion. A study of the history of religions shows that religious forms change and that there has never been unanimity on the nature and expression of religion. Whether or not man... Sexists write and edit religious articles too, of course. She returned to the text. Whether or not man is now in a new situation for developing structures of ultimate values radically different from those provided in the traditionally affirmed awareness of the sacred is a vital question.
So?
So? I think the bureaucratic religions try to institutionalize your perception of the numinous instead of providing the means so you can perceive the numinous directly. Like looking through a 6-inch telescope. If sensing the numinous is at the heart of religion, who's more religious, would you say? The people who follow the bureaucratic religions or the people who teach themselves science?
Let's see if I've got this straight, he returned.
It was a phrase of hers that he had adopted. It's a lazy Saturday afternoon, and there's this couple lying naked in bed, reading the Encyclopedia Britannica to each other and arguing about whether the Andromeda Galaxy is more numinous than the resurrection.
Whew! Do they know how to have a good time, or don't they?
Part 2. The Machine. The Almighty Lecturer, by displaying the principles of science in the structure of the universe, has invited man to study and to imitation. It is as if he had said to the inhabitants of this globe that we call ours, I have made an earth for man to dwell upon, and I have rendered the starry heavens visible to teach him science and the arts. He can now provide for his own comfort and learn from my munificence to all to be kind to each other. Thomas Paine, The Age of Reason, 1794. Chapter 10, Precession of the Equinoxes. Do we, holding that the gods exist, deceive ourselves with insubstantial dreams and lies, while random careless chance and change alone control the world? Euripides, Hecuba. It was odd the way it had worked out. She had imagined that Palmer Joss would come to the Argus facility, watch the signal being gathered in by the radio telescopes, and take note of the huge room full of magnetic tapes and discs on which the previous many months of data were stored. He would ask a few scientific questions, and then examine in its multiplicity of zeros and ones some of the reams of computer printout displaying the still incomprehensible message. She hadn't imagined spending hours arguing philosophy or theology. But Joss had refused to come to Argus. It wasn't magnetic tape he wanted to scrutinize, he said. It was human character. Peter Valerian would have been ideal for this discussion. Unpretentious, able to communicate clearly, and bulwarked by a genuine Christian faith that engaged him daily. But the president had apparently vetoed the idea. She had wanted a small meeting and had explicitly asked that Ellie attend. Joss had insisted that the discussion be held here at the Bible Science Research Institute and Museum in Modesto, California. She glanced past her here and out the glass partition that separated the library from the exhibit area. Just outside was a plaster impression from a Red River sandstone of dinosaur footprints, interspersed with those of a pedestrian in sandals, proving, so the caption said, that man and dinosaur were contemporaries, at least in Texas. Mesozoic shoemakers seemed also to be implied. The conclusion drawn in the caption was that evolution was a fraud. The opinion of many paleontologists that the sandstone was the fraud remained, Ellie had noted, 2 hours earlier, unmentioned. The intermingled footprints were part of a vast exhibit called Darwin's Default. To its left was a Foucault pendulum demonstrating the scientific assertion, this one apparently uncontested, that the Earth turns. To its right, Ellie could see part of a lavish Matsushita holography unit on the podium of a small theater, from which three-dimensional images of the most eminent divines could communicate directly to the faithful. Communicating still more directly to her at this moment was the Reverend Billy Joe Rankin. She had not known until the last moment that Joss had invited Rankin, and she was surprised at the news. There had been continuing theological disputation between them on whether an advent was at hand, whether doomsday is a necessary accompaniment of the advent, and on the role of miracles in the ministry, among other matters. But they had recently effected a widely publicized reconciliation, done, it was said, for the common good of the fundamentalist community in America. The signs of rapprochement between the United States and the Soviet Union were having worldwide ramifications in the arbitration of disputes. Holding the meeting here was perhaps part of the price Palmer Joss had to pay for the reconciliation. Conceivably, Rankin felt the exhibits would provide factual support for his position, were there any scientific points in dispute. Now, 2 hours into their discussion, Rankin was alternately castigating and imploring. His suit was immaculately tailored, his nails freshly manicured, and his beaming smile stood in some contrast to Joss's rumpled, distracted, and more weather-beaten appearance. Joss, the faintest of smiles on his face, had his eyes half-closed, and his head bowed in what seemed very close to an attitude of prayer. He had not had to say much. Rankin's remarks so far, except for the rapture rap, she guessed, were doctrinally indistinguishable from Joss's television address. "You scientists are so shy," Rankin was saying. You love to hide your light under a bushel basket. You'd never guess what's in those articles from the titles. Einstein's first work on the theory of relativity was called The Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. No E equals MC squared up front. No, sir. The Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. I suppose if God appeared to a whole gaggle of scientists, maybe at one of those big association meetings, they'd write something all about it and call it maybe On Spontaneous Dendritiform Combustion in Air. They'd have lots of equations. They'd talk about economy of hypothesis, but they'd never say a word about God. You see, you scientists are too skeptical. From the sidewise motion of his head, Ellie deduced that Jurhir was also included in this assessment. You question everything, or try to. You never heard about leave well enough alone, or if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You always want to check out if a thing is what you call true. And true means only empirical sense data, things you can see and touch. There's no room for inspiration or revelation in your world. Right from the beginning, you rule out of court almost everything religion is about. I mistrust the scientists because the scientists mistrust everything. Despite herself, she thought Rankin had put his case well, and he was supposed to be the dumb one among the modern video evangelists. No, not dumb, she corrected herself. He was the one who considered his parishioners dumb. He could, for all she knew, be very smart indeed. Should she respond at all? Both Jurhir and the local museum people were recording the discussion, and although both groups had agreed that the recordings were not for public use, she worried about embarrassing the project or the president if she spoke her mind. But Rankin's remarks had become increasingly outrageous, and no interventions were being made either by Jurhir or by Joss. I suppose you want to reply, she found herself saying. There isn't an official scientific position on any of these questions, and I can't pretend to talk for all scientists, or even for the Argus Project. But I can make some comments if you'd like. Rankin nodded his head vigorously, smiling encouragement. Languidly, Joss merely waited. I want you to understand that I'm not attacking anybody's belief system. As far as I'm concerned, you're entitled to any doctrine you like, even if it's demonstrably wrong. And many of the things you're saying, and that the Reverend Joss has said, I saw your talk on television a few weeks ago, can't be dismissed instantly. It takes a little work. But let me try to explain why I think they're improbable. So far, she thought, I've been the soul of restraint. You're uncomfortable with scientific skepticism. But the reason it developed is that the world is complicated. It's subtle. Everybody's first idea isn't necessarily right. Also, people are capable of self-deception. Scientists, too. All sorts of socially abhorrent doctrines have at one time or another been supported by scientists, well-known scientists, famous brand-name scientists, and, of course, politicians, and respected religious leaders. Slavery, for instance, or the Nazi brand of racism. Scientists make mistakes. Theologians make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. It's part of being human. You say it yourselves. To err is. So the way you avoid the mistakes, or at least reduce the chance that you'll make one, is to be skeptical. You test the ideas. You check them out by rigorous standards of evidence. I don't think there is such a thing as a received truth. But when you let the different opinions debate, when any skeptic can perform his or her own experiment to check some contention out, then the truth tends to emerge. That's the experience of the whole history of science. It isn't a perfect approach, but it's the only one that seems to work. Now, when I look at religion, I see lots of contending opinions. For example, the Christians think the universe is a finite number of years old. From the exhibits out there, it's clear that some Christians and Jews and Muslims think that the universe is only 6,000 years old. The Hindus, on the other hand, and there are lots of Hindus in the world, think that the universe is infinitely old, with an infinite number of subsidiary creations and destructions along the way. Now, they can't both be right. Either the universe is a certain number of years old, or it's infinitely old. Your friends out there, she gestured out the glass door toward several museum workers ambling past Darwin's Default, ought to debate Hindus. God seems to have told them something different from what he told you. But you tend to talk only to yourselves. Maybe a little too strong? She asked herself. The major religions on the earth contradict each other left and right. You can't all be correct. And what if all of you are wrong? That's a possibility, you know. You must care about the truth, right? Well, the way to winnow through all the differing contentions is to be skeptical. I'm not any more skeptical about your religious beliefs than I am about every new scientific idea I hear about. But in my line of work, they're called hypotheses, not inspiration, and not revelation. Joss now stirred a little, but it was Rankin who replied.
The revelations, the confirmed predictions by God in the Old Testament and the New are legion. The coming of the Savior is foretold in Isaiah 53, in Zechariah 14, in 1 Chronicles 17. That he would be born in Bethlehem was prophesied in Micah 5. That he would come from the line of David was foretold in Matthew 1 and in Luke. But that ought to be an embarrassment for you, not a fulfilled prophecy. Matthew and Luke give Jesus totally different genealogies. Worse than that, they trace the lineage from David to Joseph, not from David to Mary. Or don't you believe in God the Father?
Rankin continued smoothly on. Perhaps he hadn't understood her.
The ministry and suffering of Jesus are foretold in Isaiah 52 and 53 in the 22nd Psalm. That he would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver is explicit in Zechariah 11. If you're honest, you can't ignore the evidence of fulfilled prophecy. And the Bible speaks to our own time. Israel and the Arabs, Gog and Magog, America and Russia, nuclear war, it's all there in the Bible. Anybody with an ounce of sense can see it. You don't have to be some fancy college professor.
Your trouble, she replied, is a failure of the imagination. These prophecies are, almost every one of them, vague, ambiguous, imprecise, open to fraud. They admit lots of possible interpretations. Even the straightforward prophecies direct from the top you try to weasel out of. Like Jesus' promise that the kingdom of God would come in the lifetime of some people in his audience. And don't tell me the kingdom of God is within me. His audience understood him quite literally. You only quote the passages that seem to you fulfilled and ignore the rest. And don't forget, there was a hunger to see prophecy fulfilled. But imagine that your kind of God, omnipotent, omniscient, compassionate, really wanted to leave a record for future generations. To make his existence unmistakable, to say, the remote descendants of Moses. It's easy, trivial, just a few enigmatic phrases, and some fierce commandment that they be passed on unchanged. Joss leaned forward almost imperceptibly. Such as, the sun is a star, or Mars is a rusty place with deserts and volcanoes like Sinai, or a body in motion tends to remain in motion, or, she quickly scribbled some numbers on a pad. The earth weighs a million, 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 million times as much as a child. Or, I recognize that both of you seem to have some trouble with special relativity, but it's confirmed every day, routinely, in particle accelerators and cosmic rays. How about, there are no privileged frames of reference? Or even, thou shalt not travel faster than light? Anything they couldn't possibly have known 3,000 years ago. Any others? Joss asked. Well, there's an indefinite number of them, or at least one for every principle of physics. Heat and light hide in the smallest pebble. Or even, the way of the earth is as two, but the way of the lodestone is as three. I'm trying to suggest that the gravitational force follows an inverse square law, while the magnetic dipole force follows an inverse cube law. Or, in biology, she nodded toward Derheer, who seemed to have taken a vow of silence, how about two strands entwined is the secret of life?
Now that's an interesting one, said Joss. You're talking, of course, about DNA. But you know the physician's staff, the symbol of medicine? Army doctors wear it on their lapels. It's called the caduceus. Shows two serpents intertwined. It's a perfect double helix. From ancient times, that's been the symbol of preserving life. Isn't this exactly the kind of connection you're suggesting?
Well, I thought it's a spiral, not a helix. But if there are enough symbols and enough prophecies and enough myth and folklore, eventually a few of them are going to fit some current scientific understanding, purely by accident. But I can't be sure. Maybe you're right. Maybe the caduceus is a message from God. Of course, it's not a Christian symbol, or a symbol of any of the major religions today. I don't suppose you'd want to argue that the gods talked only to the ancient Greeks. What I'm saying is, if God wanted to send us a message, and ancient writings were the only way he could think of doing it, he could have done a better job. And he hardly had to confine himself to writings. Why isn't there a monster crucifix orbiting the earth? Why isn't the surface of the moon covered with the Ten Commandments? Why should God be so clear in the Bible and so obscure in the world? Joss had apparently been ready to reply a few sentences back, a look of genuine pleasure unexpectedly on his face. But Ellie's rush of words was gathering momentum, and perhaps he felt it impolite to interrupt. Also, why would you think that God has abandoned us? He used to chat with patriarchs and prophets every second Tuesday, you believe. He's omnipotent, you say, and omniscient. So it's no particular effort for him to remind us directly, unambiguously of his wishes, at least a few times in every generation. So how come, fellas, why don't we see him with crystal clarity?
We do.
Rankin put enormous feeling in this phrase.
He is all around us. Our prayers are answered. Tens of millions of people in this country have been born again and have witnessed God's glorious grace. The Bible speaks to us as clearly in this day as it did in the time of Moses and Jesus. Oh, come off it, you know what I mean. Where are the burning bushes? The pillars of fire, the great voice that says, I am that I am, booming down at us out of the sky.
Why should God manifest himself in such subtle and debatable ways when he can make his presence completely unambiguous?
But a voice from the sky is just what you say you found.
Joss made this comment casually, while Ellie paused for breath. He held her eyes with his own.
Rankin quickly picked up the thought.
Absolutely. Just what I was going to say. Abraham and Moses, they didn't have radios or telescopes. They couldn't have heard the Almighty talking on FM.
Maybe today God talks to us in new ways and permits us to have a new understanding.
Or maybe it's not God. Yes, Satan, I've heard some talk about that. It sounds crazy. Let's leave that one alone for a moment, if it's okay with you.
You think maybe the message is the voice of God? Your God. Where in your religion does God answer a prayer by repeating the prayer back?
I wouldn't call a Nazi newsreel a prayer myself, Joss said. You say it's to attract our attention.
Then why do you think God has chosen to talk to scientists? Why not preachers like yourself?
Oh, God talks to me all the time.
Rankin's index finger audibly thumped his sternum.
And the Reverend Joss here. God has told me that a revelation is at hand. When the end of the world is nigh, the rapture will be upon us, the judgment of sinners, the ascension to heaven of the elect.
Did he tell you he was going to make that announcement in the radio spectrum? Is your conversation with God recorded somewhere so we can verify that it really happened? Or do we have only your say-so? Why would God choose to announce it to radio astronomers and not to men and women of the cloth? Don't you think it's a little strange that the first message from God in 2,000 years or more is prime numbers? And Adolf Hitler at the 1936 Olympics? Your God must have quite a sense of humor.
My God can have any sense he wants to have.
Jurhir was clearly alarmed at the first appearance of real rancor.
Maybe I could remind us all about what we hope to accomplish at this meeting? He began.
Here's Ken in his mollifying mode, Ellie thought. On some issues, he's courageous, but chiefly when he has no responsibility for action. He's a brave talker, in private, but on scientific politics, and especially when representing the president, he becomes very accommodating, ready to compromise with the devil himself. She caught herself. The theological language was getting to her. Oh, that's another thing. She interrupted her own train of thought as well as Jahir's. If that signal is from God, why does it come from just one place in the sky, in the vicinity of a particularly bright nearby star? Why doesn't it come from all over the sky at once, like the cosmic black-body background radiation? Coming from one star, it looks like a signal from another civilization. Coming from everywhere, it would look much more like a signal from your God.
God can make a signal come from the bunghole of the little bear if he wants.
Rankin's face was becoming bright red.
Excuse me, but you've gotten me riled up. God can do anything.
Anything you don't understand, Mr. Rankin, you attribute to God. God for you is where you sweep away all the mysteries of the world, all the challenges to our intelligence. You simply turn your mind off and say God did it.
Ma'am, I didn't come here to be insulted.
Come here? I thought this was where you lived.
Ma'am!
Rankin was about to say something, but then thought better of it. He took a deep breath and continued.
This is a Christian country, and Christians have true knowledge on this issue, a sacred responsibility to make sure that God's sacred word is understood.
I'm a Christian, and you don't speak for me.
You've trapped yourself in some sort of 5th-century religious mania. Since then, the Renaissance has happened. The Enlightenment has happened. Where have you been?
Both Joss and Jurhir were half out of their chairs.
Please, Ken implored, looking directly at Ellie. If we don't keep more to the agenda, I don't see how we can accomplish what the president asked us to.
Well, you wanted a frank exchange of views.
It's nearly noon, Joss observed. Why don't we take a little break for lunch?
Outside the library conference room, leaning on the railing surrounding the Foucault pendulum, Ellie began a brief whispered exchange with Jahir.
I'd like to punch out that cocksure know-it-all holier-than-thou.
Why exactly, Ellie? Aren't ignorance and error painful enough?
Yes, if he'd shut up. But he's corrupting millions.
Sweetheart, he thinks the same about you. When she and Jahir came back from lunch, Ellie noticed immediately that Rankin appeared subdued, while Joss, who was first to speak, seemed cheerful, certainly beyond the requirements of mere cordiality.
Dr. Arroway, he began, I can understand that you're impatient to show us your findings, and that you didn't come here for theological disputation. But please bear with us just a bit longer. You have a sharp tongue. I can't recall the last time Brother Rankin here got so stirred up on matters of the faith. It must be years.
He glanced momentarily at his colleague, who was doodling apparently idly on a yellow legal pad, his collar unbuttoned and his necktie loosened.
I was struck by one or two things you said this morning. You called yourself a Christian. May I ask, in what sense are you a Christian?
You know, this wasn't in the job description when I accepted the directorship of the Argus Project. She said this lightly. I'm a Christian in the sense that I find Jesus Christ to be an admirable historical figure. I think the Sermon on the Mount is one of the greatest ethical statements and one of the best speeches in history. I think that love your enemy might even be the long-shot solution to the problem of nuclear war. I wish he was alive today. It would benefit everybody on the planet. But I think Jesus was only a man. A great man, a brave man, a man with insight into unpopular truths, but I don't think he was God or the Son of God or the grandnephew of God.
You don't want to believe in God.
Joss said it as a simple statement.
You figure you can be a Christian and not believe in God. Well, let me ask you straight out. Do you believe in God?
The
question has a peculiar structure if I say no. Do I mean I'm convinced God doesn't exist, or do I mean I'm not convinced he does exist? Those are two very different statements. Let's see if they are so different, Dr. Arroway. Oh, may I call you doctor? You believe in Occam's razor, isn't that right? If you have two different, equally good explanations of the same experience, you pick the simplest? The whole history of science supports it, you say. Now, if you have serious doubts about whether there is a God, enough doubts so you're unwilling to commit yourself to the faith, then you must be able to imagine a world without God. A world that comes into being without God. A world that goes about its everyday life without God. A world where people die without God. No punishment. No reward. All the saints and prophets, all the faithful who have ever lived, why, you'd have to believe they were foolish. Deceived themselves, you'd probably say. That would be a world in which we weren't here on Earth for any good reason. I mean, for any purpose. It would all be just complicated collisions of atoms. Is that right? Including the atoms that are inside human beings? To me, that would be a hateful and inhuman world. I wouldn't want to live in it. But if you can imagine that world, why straddle? Why occupy some middle ground? If you believe all that already, isn't it much simpler to say, there's no God? You're not being true to Occam's razor. I think you're waffling. How can a thoroughgoing, conscientious scientist be an agnostic if you can even imagine a world without God? Wouldn't you just have to be an atheist? I thought you were going to argue that God is the simpler hypothesis, Ellie said. But this is a much better point. If it were only a matter of scientific discussion, I'd agree with you, Reverend Joss. Science is essentially concerned with examining and correcting hypotheses. If the laws of nature explain all the available facts without supernatural intervention, or even do only as well as the God hypothesis, then for the time being I'd call myself an atheist. Then if a single piece of evidence was discovered that doesn't fit, I'd back off from atheism. We're fully able to detect some breakdown in the laws of nature. The reason I don't call myself an atheist is because this isn't mainly a scientific issue. It's a religious issue and a political issue. The tentative nature of scientific hypothesis doesn't extend into these fields. You don't talk about God as a hypothesis. You think you've cornered the truth. So I point out that you may have missed a thing or two. But if you ask, I'm happy to tell you, I can't be sure I'm right. I've always thought an agnostic is an atheist without the courage of his convictions. You could just as well say that an agnostic is a deeply religious person with at least a rudimentary knowledge of human fallibility. When I say I'm an agnostic, I only mean that the evidence isn't in. There isn't compelling evidence that God exists, at least your kind of God. And there isn't compelling evidence that he doesn't, since more than half the people on the earth aren't Jews or Christians or Muslims. I'd say that there aren't any compelling arguments for your kind of God. Otherwise, everybody on earth would have been converted. I say again, if your God wanted to convince us, he could have done a much better job. Look at how clearly authentic the message is. It's being picked up all over the world. Radio telescopes are humming away in countries with different histories, different languages, different politics, different religions. Everybody's getting the same kind of data from the same place in the sky, at the same frequencies with the same polarization modulation. The Muslims, the Hindus, the Christians, and the atheists are all getting the same message. Any skeptic can hook up a radio telescope. It doesn't have to be very big, and get the identical data.
You're not suggesting that your radio message is from God, Rankin offered.
Not at all. Just that the civilization on Vega, with powers infinitely less than what you attribute to your God, was able to make things very clear. If your God wanted to talk to us through the unlikely means of word-of-mouth transmission and ancient writings over thousands of years, he could have done it so there was no room left for debate about his existence. She paused, but neither Joss nor Rankin spoke, so she tried again to steer the conversation to the data. Why don't we just withhold judgment for a while until we make some more progress on decrypting the message? Would you like to see some of the data? This time they assented. Readily enough, it seemed. But she could produce only reams of zeros and ones, neither edifying nor inspirational. She carefully explained about the presumed pagination of the message and the hoped-for primer. By unspoken agreement, she and Durheer said nothing about the Soviet view that the message was the blueprint for a machine. It was at best a guess and had not yet been publicly discussed by the Soviets. As an afterthought, she described something about Vega itself. Its mass, surface temperature, color, distance from the Earth, lifetime, and the ring of orbiting debris around it that had been discovered by the infrared astronomy satellite in 1983. But beyond its being one of the brightest stars in the sky, is there anything special about it? Joss wanted to know. Or anything that connects it up with the Earth? Well, in terms of stellar properties, anything like that, I can't think of a thing. But there is one incidental fact. Vega was the pole star about 12,000 years ago, and it will be again about 14,000 years from now.
I thought the pole star was the pole star. Rankin, still doodling, said this to the pad of paper.
It is. For a few thousand years, but not forever. The Earth is like a spinning top. Its axis is slowly precessing in a circle. She demonstrated, using her pencil as the Earth's axis. It's called the precession of the equinoxes.
Discovered by Hipparchus of Rhodes, added Joss. 2nd century B.C.
This seemed a surprising piece of information for him to have at his fingertips. Exactly. So, right now, she continued, an arrow from the center of the Earth to the North Pole points to the star we call Polaris, in the constellation of the Little Dipper, or the Little Bear. I believe you were referring to this constellation just before lunch, Mr. Rankin. As the Earth's axis slowly precesses, it points in some different direction in the sky, not toward Polaris. And over 26,000 years, the place in the sky to which the North Pole points makes a complete circle. The North Pole points right now very near Polaris, close enough to be useful in navigation. 12,000 years ago, by accident, it pointed to Vega. But there's no physical connection. How the stars are distributed in the Milky Way has nothing to do with the Earth's axis of rotation being tipped 23.5 degrees.
Now, 12,000 years ago is 10,000 B.C., the time when civilization was just starting up, isn't that right?
Joss asked.
Unless you believe that the Earth was created in 4,004 B.C. Now, we don't believe that, do we, Brother Rankin? We just don't think the age of the Earth is known with the same precision that you scientists do. On the question of the age of the Earth, we're what you might call agnostics.
He had a most attractive smile.
So if folks were navigating 10,000 years ago, sailing the Mediterranean, say, or the Persian Gulf, Vega would have been their guide?
Oh, that's still in the last ice age. Probably a little early for navigation. But the hunters who crossed the Bering Land Bridge to North America were around then. It must have seemed an amazing gift. Providential, if you like, that such a bright star was exactly to the north. I'll bet a lot of people owed their lives to that coincidence.
Well, now that's mighty interesting. I don't want you to think I used the word providential as anything but a metaphor. I'd never think that, my dear.
Joss was by now giving signs that the afternoon was drawing to a close, and he did not seem displeased. But there were still a few items, it seemed, on Rankin's agenda.
It amazes me that you don't think it was divine providence, Vega being the pole star.
My faith is so strong, I don't need proofs. But every time a new fact comes along, it simply confirms my faith. Well then, I guess you weren't listening very closely to what I was saying this morning. I resent the idea that we're in some kind of faith contest, and you're the hands-down winner. So far as I know, you've never tested your faith. Are you willing to put your life on the line for your faith? I'm willing to do it for mine. Here, take a look out that window. There's a big Foucault pendulum out there. The bob must weigh 500 pounds. My faith says that the amplitude of a free pendulum, how far it'll swing away from the vertical position, can never increase. It can only decrease. I'm willing to go out there, put the bob in front of my nose, let go, have it swing away, and then back toward me. If my beliefs are in error, I'll get a 500-pound pendulum smack in the face. Come on. You want to test my faith?
Truly, it's not necessary.
I believe you, replied Joss. Rankin, though, seemed interested. He was imagining she guessed what she would look like afterward.
But would you be willing, she went on, to stand a foot closer to this same pendulum and pray to God to shorten the swing?
What if it turns out that you've gotten it all wrong? That what you're teaching isn't God's will at all? Maybe it's the work of the devil. Maybe it's pure human invention. How can you be really sure?
Faith, inspiration, revelation, awe,
Rankin answered.
Don't judge everyone else by your own limited experience. Just the fact that you've rejected the Lord doesn't prevent other folks from acknowledging his glory.
Look, we all have a thirst for wonder. It's a deeply human quality. Science and religion are both bound up with it. What I'm saying is you don't have to make stories up, you don't have to exaggerate. There's wonder and awe enough in the real world. Nature's a lot better at inventing wonders than we are.
Perhaps we are all wayfarers on the road to truth, Joss replied. On this hopeful note, Durheer stepped in deftly, and amid strained civilities they prepared to leave.
She wondered whether anything useful had been accomplished.
Valerian would have been much more effective and much less provocative, Ellie thought. She wished she had kept herself in better check. It's been a most interesting day, Dr. Arroway, and I thank you for it.
Joss seemed a little remote again, courtly but distracted. He shook her hand warmly, though. On the way out to the waiting government car, past the lavishly rendered three-dimensional exhibit on the fallacy of the expanding universe, a sign read, "Our God is alive and well. Sorry about yours." She whispered to Durheer,
"I'm sorry if it made your job more difficult."
"Oh, no, Ellie. You were fine." "That Palmer Joss is a very attractive man. I don't think I did much to convert him. But I'll tell you, he almost converted me." She was joking, of course. Chapter 11. The World Message Consortium. The world is nearly all parceled out, and what there is left of it is being divided up, conquered, and colonized. To think of these stars that you see overhead at night, these vast worlds which we can never reach, I would annex the planets if I could. I often think of that. It makes me sad to see them so clear, and yet so far. Cecil Rhodes, Last Will and Testament, 1902. From their table by the window, she could see the downpour spattering the street outside. A soaked pedestrian, his collar up, gamely hurried by. The proprietor had cranked the striped awning over the tubs of oysters, segregated according to size and quality, and providing a kind of street advertisement for the specialty of the house. She felt warm and snug inside the restaurant, the famous theatrical gathering place, Chez Dieu. Since fair weather had been predicted, she was without raincoat or umbrella. Likewise unencumbered, Vege introduced a new subject.
"My friend Mira," he announced, "is an ecclesiast."
"That is the right word, yes. When she works in your country, she performs for groups of professionals at meetings and conventions.
Mira says that when she takes off her clothes for working-class men at trade union conventions, that sort of thing, they become wild, shout out improper suggestions, and try to join her on the stage. But when she gives exactly the same performance for doctors or lawyers, they sit there motionless. Actually, she says, some of them lick their lips. My question is, are the lawyers healthier than the steelworkers?
That Vege had diverse female acquaintances had always been apparent. His approaches to women were so direct and extravagant, herself, for some reason that both pleased and annoyed her, excluded, that they could always say no without embarrassment. Many said yes. But the news about Mira was a little unexpected. They had spent the morning in a last-minute comparison of notes and interpretations of the new data. The continuing message transmission had reached an important new stage. Diagrams were being transmitted from Vega, the way newspaper wire photos are transmitted. Each picture was an array raster. The number of tiny black and white dots that made up the picture was the product of two prime numbers. Again, prime numbers were part of the transmission. There was a large set of such diagrams, one following the other, and not at all interleaved with the text. It was like a section of glossy illustrations inserted in the back of a book. Following transmission of the long sequence of diagrams, the unintelligible text continued. From at least some of the diagrams, it seemed obvious that Vege and Arkhangelsky had been right, that the message was in part at least the instructions, the blueprints for building a machine. Its purpose was unknown. At the plenary session of the World Message Consortium, to be held tomorrow at the Elysee Palace, she and Vege would present for the first time some of the details to representatives of the other consortium nations. But word had quietly been passed about the machine hypothesis. Over lunch, she had summarized her encounter with Rankin and Joss. Vege had been attentive, but asked no questions. It was as if she had been confessing some unseemly personal predilection, and perhaps that had triggered his train of association. "You have a friend named Mira who's a striptease artist? With international venue?"
Since Wolfgang Pauli discovered the exclusion principle while watching the Folies Bergère, I have felt it my professional duty as a physicist to visit Paris as much as possible. I think of it as my homage to Pauli. But somehow I can never persuade the officials in my country to approve trips solely for this purpose. Usually I must do some pedestrian physics as well. But in such establishments, that's where I met Mira. I am a student of nature, waiting for insight to strike.
Abruptly, his tone of voice shifted from expansive to matter-of-fact.
Mira says American professional men are sexually repressed and have gnawing doubts and guilt.
Really? And what does Mira say about Russian professional men?
In that category she knows only me, so of course she has a good opinion. I think I'd rather be with Mira tomorrow.
But all your friends will be at the consortium meeting, she said lightly.
Yes, I'm glad you'll be there,
he replied morosely. What's worrying you, Vege? He took a long time before answering, and began with a slight but uncharacteristic hesitation.
Perhaps not worries, maybe only concerns. What if the message really is the design drawings of a machine? Do we build a machine? Who builds it? Everybody together? The consortium? The United Nations? A few nations in competition? What if it's enormously expensive to build? Who pays? Why should they want to? What if it doesn't work? Could building the machine injure some nations economically? Could it injure them in some other way?
Without interrupting this torrent of questions, Lunacharsky emptied the last of the wine into their glasses. Even if the message cycles back, and even if we completely decrypt it, how good could the translation be?
You know the opinion of Cervantes? He said that reading a translation is like examining the back of a piece of tapestry. Maybe it's not possible to translate the message perfectly. Then we wouldn't build a machine perfectly. Also, are we really confident we have all the data? Maybe there's essential information at some other frequency that we haven't discovered yet. You know, Ellie, I thought people would be very cautious about building this machine. But there may be some coming tomorrow who will urge immediate construction. I mean immediately after we receive the primer and decrypt the message, assuming that we do. What is the American delegation going to propose?
I don't know, she said slowly. But she remembered that soon after the diagrammatic material had been received, Jurhir began asking whether it was likely that the machine was within reach of the Earth's economy and technology. She could offer him little reassurance on either score. She recalled again how preoccupied Ken had seemed in the last few weeks, sometimes even jittery. His responsibilities in this matter were, of course...
Are Dr. Derheer and Mr. Kitts staying at the same hotel as you?
No, they're staying at the embassy. It was always the case. Because of the nature of the Soviet economy and the perceived necessity of buying military technology instead of consumer goods with their limited hard currency, Russians had little walking around money when visiting the West. They were obliged to stay in second- or third-rate hotels, even rooming houses, while their Western colleagues lived in comparative luxury. It was a continuing source of embarrassment for scientists of both countries. Picking up the bill for this relatively simple meal would be effortless for Ellie, but a burden for Vege, despite his comparatively exalted status in the Soviet scientific hierarchy. Now, what was Vege? Vege, be straight with me. What are you saying? You think Ken and Mike Kitts are jumping the gun?
Straight. An interesting word. Not right, not left, but progressively forward. I'm concerned that in the next few days we will see premature discussion about building something that we have no right to build. The politicians think we know everything.
In fact, we know almost nothing. Such a situation could be dangerous. It finally dawned on her that Vege was taking a personal responsibility for figuring out the nature of the message. If it led to some catastrophe, he was worried it might be his fault. He had less personal motives as well, of course. You want me to talk to Ken? If you think it's appropriate, you have frequent opportunities to talk to him? He said this casually. Vege, you're not jealous, are you?